Let's. And I'm just going to ask you, just for the background, really, more for my own information. You're Canadian and you specialise in heritage wheats. How did that come about? What's the story of how you got to where you are now?
Oh, goodness. When I was a boy growing up on a farm and in farmland areas, I was very interested in gardening and plants and seeds. When other kids were probably playing ice hockey, I was out, I don't know, collecting seeds, or not quite in the winter. But I think I considered myself to be a bit of a Johnny Appleseed, so I started collecting all sorts of seeds. I had a seed collection when I was about 10. So I suppose the story starts there. And I went on and, you know, working in the fields, I was very interested in, well, I suppose in plant breeding, in developing new types of crops that I thought would help feed the world, you know. So when I went off to uni in Canada, I did environmental science and botany, but always specializing in genetics and plant genetics, and I was going to be a plant breeder. But then I had a bit of a transformation at uni after a couple of years when I realized that the problem of feeding the world wasn't that we don't have, that we needed new fancy crops that were higher yielding. That was not the issue. And even if you make, you know, breed new high yielding super wheats that give you three times the yield, it takes three times the fertilizer and the herbicides and the fungicides and all the other chemicals that you need to make that happen. And of course, what's the impact of that on the environment and on people, on the quality of their food? So anyway, I think the problems, I had quite a change of approach, I suppose, in thinking that the problems were more, you know, economic and social changes in many ways. So I finished the course, nevertheless, but I got very much into archaeological. I wanted to know about how humans had come to become farmers. You know, the agricultural revolution and how crops became domesticated, how we moved from being hunter gatherers to farmers, because in that transition, there were so many. Obviously, the most massive social change we've ever had, and what the impact on our diet. So. And in that period, I met an English girl in Canada. I suppose that was another significant event. And I moved to Britain and lived in London. And literally, I was walking by, I was accidentally walking by the Institute of Archaeology in London at UCL one day in the mid-80s, and was working in a restaurant. I was working in a vegetarian restaurant called Crank's, which was a well-known vegetarian chain at the time. And there was a sign up that said summer courses in archaeology. I thought, ooh, yes. What I'd like to know, you see, I want to know about the history of something like wheat, and how did wheat go from being a wild grass to a cultivated crop that we, you know, is a staff of life that we depend on for so many of our food, and so for other crops too. So I ended up doing a master's degree in archaeobotany, archaeological botany. Our Canadians call it paleoethnobotany, which is an even better term. Anyway. And I worked with someone named Gordon Hillman, who was this amazing man, David Harris and Gordon Hillman. They were the experts on the origins of agriculture. And so I spent a lot of time looking at ancient crops and seeds from archaeological sites. Ended up, after that, going to Oxford, where I worked at the University Museum, looking at a lot of, Roman, Anglo-Saxon, all the... When you do an archaeological excavation, you find potsherds and bits of metal and everything else, but you also find seeds, if you look for them. And there's been a lot of interest over the last 20, 30 years in looking at the history of the human diet and history of changes in the environment and landscape, all based on looking at plant remains. So that's what I did, and I was quite interested in medieval plant remains because I was quite interested in, to be honest, in that contact with the New World and the Old World and how the crops that were European crops were introduced to North America and transformed the landscape and the diet there. And the same thing, you know, tomatoes, peanuts, maize, all the stuff that came from the New World came over here. And the effect that it's had on our diets, like we've just had pizza with tomato sauce, you know, it's just pretty much a staple. So I was interested in all of that thing. I worked in Turkey for several summers. I worked in the Canadian Arctic for a summer. That was very interesting, living with the Inuit, looking at Inuit food patterns. But I was actually working on the first European settlement actually in Canada is a fellow named Sir Martin Frobisher, who was used to be a friend of Drake's, but they fell out. And he went to find a route through the Northwest Passage, and we found his base camp frozen in the ice. And I was looking at the food on board the ships. And anyway, I worked on various projects. And in about 1993-94, while at the museum, I am getting around to wheat in the end, while working at the museum in Oxford, a friend walked in with a shoebox, which he told me was full of medieval wheat. I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. And he said it came from a thatched roof. Well, the three of us who were there, three archaeobotanists, one with a great deal of experience, said, well, that's impossible. Wheat couldn't survive on a thatched roof for that long because it would compost. It would, you know, rot away. And having not grown up on in a thatched roof, I didn't know very much about thatching at all. I'd seen a few of these buildings. But I had no idea how thatch works. And now I know a lot more about it because since then, since about 1994, really has been the core of all my research and all my work. As it turns out, this shoebox was full of thatch. If you looked at it, what you would see is ears of wheat and straw covered with soot. That's what it looked like. It looked like, you know, well, not modern wheat, but looked like wheat. You could take a sheaf of wheat and hold it over a fire, and it was covered with smoke, covered with soot, and that's what it looked like. And it turns out it came from the bottom layer of the thatch. And what no one had realized was the way thatching used to work, it isn't done this way anymore. But historically, when you build a building, so let's say it's 1350, you would tie down the bottom layer of thatch and then put a weathering coat on top of that. And that would last for 30 years. And then after it would decay in 30 years, you'd put another layer on, and so on, and so on, and so on, for 600 years. Now, obviously, you would have a very thick roof if you left it all on there, but the roof is, you know, partially rotting back, then expanding, putting a new layer on. But the point is, what you have on that roof is a bottom layer that's never been replaced, so it's a snapshot of a medieval field. You've got all these amazing cereals, which are no longer grown. It's, you know, 600 years ago. So it gives you this record of the type of wheat that was grown in the medieval period, but also of what came before that, because obviously, where did it come from? It traces back, who knows, into the Saxon period, into the Roman period. So you've got genetically and morphologically a record of the history of wheat. But also, because you have this layered effect going on, every 30 years you put a new layer of thatch on, you've got a chronology of all the changes that have happened in cereals since the medieval period. So you've got this amazing snapshot record of not just the cereals, but the weeds that grew in these crops. So you can look at things like crop rotations. And where else do we have this information? Some of it's written in books and medieval records, some manorial records, but the manorial records we have, the written sources of medieval farming, relate to the large estates, the monasteries. They don't reflect what the people ate, the masses of the people. And what I found interesting right from the beginning was that most of the wheat that you find in medieval buildings was a mixture of wheat and rye. It was a maslin, as they called it at the time. A mixture of wheat and rye. Rye is a very nutritious grain of all the grains. So they might have grown pure wheat, for the king's table or for the higher echelons of society, but your average person ate maslin, so a rye-rich bread, maybe some other grains mixed in, a bit of barley if they had it, or oats perhaps, but not a great deal of wheat, and baked, of course, in the sourdough way. Now, just to draw that story for a second, I've picked up those threads in my business and my life now, but that drew me into the whole thatching world, because when I was taking this ancient thatch off of roofs, the thatchers were next to me. I didn't know much about thatching at the time, but I certainly spent a lot of time, and have over the last 15, 20 years now, spent a great deal of time on thatched roofs. But the thatchers were immediately saying, the straw that I'm pulling out that's 500 years old is better quality than the straw they're putting on today, because wheat has become much shorter through plant breeding. And it's too short to be used as thatching, really. Modern wheat is all, every wheat on the permitted list that you're allowed to grow officially through DEFRA rules, FSSA rules, is too short for thatching. So the old wheat that I was finding was 5 or 6 foot tall, which is, quite striking when you see it, but it makes for great thatch. So obviously, the longer it is, the longer it's going to last. So thatchers were very, very interested in these old wheats. So there was a practical result from the archaeology, as it were. I'm not just interested in archaeology for archaeology's sake, as interesting as that is. I want to be practical. I want to apply that. So I thought, well, I'll just start growing these old varieties. I said, where can we get these things? And, well, gene banks around the world do have accessions of these old varieties, nobody really knows much about them. You know, like the gene bank here in at the John Innes Centre in Norwich, they'll grow them out every once in a while to keep the germination going. And only a trickle, a little fraction of the wheat that was grown, let's say, and growing in a field in 1450 has survived in those modern gene banks, because the seeds in this old thatch that I found in the roofs is dead. A wheat seed will only live for 5 years or thereabouts. It's like I always say, it's like a car running on idle. It runs out of petrol eventually, and so does the seed. Certainly of cereals, of a cultivated crop, wild seeds can last for a long time, as any farmer who ploughs up an old field will find that they'll immediately have crop weeds coming up, even though the field hasn't been ploughed in 30 or 40 years. But it doesn't work that way for wheat. So I can't plant the wheat seeds from this ancient thatch. But what I can do is look at the ears of wheat and say, oh, interesting, this has got, you know, this is a Triticum astivum bread wheat or a rivet wheat, Triticum tertium wheat, and it has hairy glooms, or it has a certain structure to the, you know, the morphology of the ear allows you to select from the gene bank, you know, the types that were grown at the time. So I decided I would recreate a medieval field, the best that we could. Anyway, I can't guarantee that it has everything in it, but I did. So I collected wheat varieties from gene banks around the world, hundreds and hundreds, and blended them all together. And that's the key difference between ancient wheats and modern wheat fields, is that in the past, every plant in a wheat field was genetically a little bit different, which means it functioned a bit differently. It means it, you know, it had, every plant had a different tolerance to cold or to wet, or different depth of root systems or different height of stem. For every characteristic, you had a range of you know, expression of that, of those genes. So you get great variety. So the field was just, you know, in a modern sense, any of my uncles in Canada would say it's a mess. You know, it's not a uniform modern wheat, because all that plant breeding's done is narrowed that genetic base. So now we have a wheat field where every plant is a clone. They're genetically almost identical. And there are problems with that, because the modern varieties are bred to respond very specific, to respond to very specific growing conditions. You know, modern varieties basically need lots of nitrogen. They need artificial fertilizer. They're so short, they can't outcompete weeds. I mean, you know, wheat is just a wild grass that evolved in the Middle East, and it evolved constantly competing against weeds. So the stems grew very, very tall to outgrow the weeds, basically. So if you grow these old varieties, as I'm doing, they literally snuff out the weeds. Having said that, I mean, you've got to start, you know, you've got to have tillage and do things properly to try to kill the weeds in the first place. There's always a botanical battleground there in an organic field. Anyway, modern wheats are too short, so you need herbicides to control the weeds. And then, because everything's similar, if you get a disease in there, a virus or a mildew or something like that, it spreads like wildfire, because every plant is genetically identical. Whereas in a medieval field, or let's say a population, a genetically diverse population of older weeds, a disease comes in. It might take out 10% of the susceptible lines, but the other 90% are going to struggle on. So you're going to end up with a crop. So these older crops, the crops of our ancestors, were very resilient in the face of terrible environmental conditions. I mean, look at the climate change we're under right now. You know, it can hardly grow cereals anymore. You can't put in spring wheats, it's too wet. You can't put them in the autumn, it's too wet. You know, who knows? You have a drought one day and then 1 week, and then the next week it rains more than ever. So you need a crop that's climate-proofed, in a sense. And the only way to do that, as far as I can see, is to have genetic diversity. I mean, you can have the most modern high-yielding wheat and pump a field full of nitrogen and everything else, but if the weather is no good, and if the root system, for example, is very shallow, which is what modern varieties tend to have, very shallow root systems, the minute it doesn't get rain, the minute there's a drought, they'll keel over. Whereas these ancient wheats have these massive root systems. And they also form good connections with root fungi, mycorrhiza, so they really draw all the nutrients that are there up into the plant. Modern wheats, I always refer to them as kind of cosseted, drug-addicted little varieties, that if you don't have those inputs, you're not going to get the yield. And there's a knock-on effect of those inputs. What are those inputs? Well, you know, fungicides, pesticides, look what's happening to our bees. You know, everything that you do is, it ultimately comes down to oil. And the way we're growing cereals is extremely energy demanding, let alone the importation of grain from abroad. So anyway, so what I've tried to do here is to, on a small scale, I want to develop a small scale model of how to grow cereals, because growing cereals isn't like growing carrots. I mean, you can grow a patch of carrots and dig them up, and that's fine. You can even get 10 people together and grow a big field of carrots, and that's fine. Growing cereals? I mean, how are you going to harvest them? You know, with a sickle? I've cut with a sickle, you know, not quite acres. I never got that far, but, you know, a good quarter of an acre of wheat by hand, as it used to be done. And also with a scythe. And I'm not a bad scyther, but my goodness, it's a chore. You know, if you're going to if bread is going to remain the staff of life, and you're a smallholder, you want to grow it on a small scale, you've got a lot of work ahead of you. So I wanted to look at how you can successfully grow cereals on a smaller scale, or let's say in a sustainable way as well, and also process those crops into good flour and other products, and, you know, hopefully try to turn it into a viable business or a viable activity for people. Because, you know, there's so much land where we could be growing more cereals. We don't need to import them. And also there's this claim that, you know, you have to use, to make good bread, you have to have imported grain from Canada or the Ukraine, or, you know, we're being flooded. Both organic grain and conventional grain is flooding in from Kazakhstan and the Ukraine and, you know, everywhere else. And millers and bakers will say, oh, well, we need that Canadian flour, and of course I wouldn't try to support Canadian flour, but actually I think we can grow it all here. We, you know, certainly people used to make very decent bread in the past. The whole baking system has changed. Obviously we have industrial baking, and even modern, you know, artisan style bakers are used to modern strong flours. So I wanted, and the other claim is that, oh, there's not enough protein in British wheat and in these old heritage varieties. They never have enough gluten, they never have enough protein. Well, I've grown old varieties that had 16% and more protein. There's no problem with the protein. It's a different kind of protein. It's true. It's not quite as strong as modern protein. Well, I say that. I mean, that varies. And it varies a lot with the seasons. You know, if you have a hot summer, you have high protein. That's why you import it from hot countries, because that's where you get, you know, the gluten strength. But it's also about the baking system. And, you know, for thousands of years, we ate sourdough bread. Yeasted bread, what we're doing now, is a fairly recent thing, the last few hundred years. Really, and sourdough bread is far healthier than the yeasted bread, for lots of reasons. In the past, it used to detoxify the grain, which could sometimes be contaminated with things like ergot and all these other things. But sourdough is incredibly healthy. It doesn't need to be sour to be a good sourdough bread. But basically, a long fermentation period, whether it's yeasted or sourdough, it kind of semi digests the flour. Makes it far more available and nutritious for you. And, you know, we have an epidemic of celiac disease and gluten intolerance and wheat intolerance and all these things. Well, why? Well, really, modern bread baking, as you'll know from the Real Bread Campaign and others, takes about 27 minutes or something to make a loaf, some ridiculously short amount of time. Actually, it was just developed up the road in Shortywood. And, you know, it's 7-minute fermentation with, like, buckets of yeast and you know, liquid cooled at the end and sliced, and you've got a loaf of bread in half an hour. Well, you're eating raw flour, as I can see, and lots of chemicals that you throw in to make that process work. You know, all the weird fungal enzymes and everything else. And that's just not what we're designed to eat. You know, no wonder we have problems with our guts. So we have to move back towards eating proper food, proper bread. That's covering a lot of ground, but so you've got the growing element, the growing the ancient cereals, and then there's the whole processing and handling of large quantities of cereals. It's a real challenge. I mean, I've got some very interesting equipment here, like small-scale stuff, you know, grain polishers, and I've got flaking machines now in my own wonderful French stone mill, and because the only way, really, you're going to make a living at this, there's no money in growing grain on a small scale. You can't possibly make a living as a farmer, especially if you don't have very much kit. If you're born with lots of equipment and 1,000 acres, perhaps you can continue to make a living for now. The only way to do it is to, if you're growing it yourself, is obviously to process it yourself, clean it and mill it, and turn it into higher value products. And the higher value products are, what, bread is to some degree, pasta, biscuits, all those things that people won't buy. So that's what I'm trying to do. So connecting all the dots, I want to show that you can grow heritage cereals in a sustainable, environmentally, you know, very friendly way, get very reasonable yields, as much as any other organic farmer is getting. I don't manure my fields. I undersow with clover, and I'm actually looking at planting in the summer, strangely enough, but it works. I'm going to then take that grain myself, you know, mill it, process it all, and ensure that that can be done in an economically viable way. And I was very lucky to get a grant from the Prince of Wales Countryside Fund, which has helped me get some kit, and also the Leader Project, actually. Because there are so many, I think there are a lot of people who want to get involved in such food-producing kind of activities, but, you know, how do you do that? How do you do that in terms of equipment or getting access to land and all these things? So there are some grants out there. Anyway, and then the next stage is obviously to produce some very interesting products and to market them, hopefully mostly locally, you know, farm shops and at the farm gate here. And I've got an excellent baker named Sid Aston, who's the first organic baker in London who just loves these heritage flours, and he's making wonderful bread. And another baker friend down in Brighton named Michael Hansen, who's an excellent artisan baker as well. He's got a little pizzeria bakehouse down there. And he just loves all these old grains, the einkorn rye mix he's over the moon with. And Sid's making a wonderful loaf with the maslin, the medieval loaf. People are coming up to the stall saying, could I have some medieval bread, please? You know, long ferment, sourdough, much healthier. So you can see there's lots of different tangents in all this. Oh, and what I haven't said is that for all these crops, the straw is a byproduct for thatching. Well, to be honest, I started off with the grain as a byproduct, but it's kind of flipped around now. But the straw is very good for thatching. You know, it takes some effort to process it and, you know, cut it with a reaper binder. But I've got a special piece of kit that I helped design that I've had built, which is a incredibly efficient small-scale straw comber, which hopefully will replace the big, massive combine harvester type, or not combine harvester, but old threshing machines. So there's lots of different elements that come into it. So, you know, it's archaeology, it's thatching, I suppose, it's baking. I did work as a baker for a while, way back as a chef years ago in London. And all these things, I think, come together. So I don't know if that's the story. I've never quite said it in such a kind of continuous way. But those are the elements of the story. And it seems to be working. The one thing I think I've been, in a sense, missing, which I'm looking forward to do, is that I've been very cereal-based. It's arable, and on the farm I'm at, it's pretty much an abandoned farm, and the arable was never a big component, so I've got some very weedy fields and some very low fertility. But actually, I want low fertility, because if I add any fertility to my fields, my weeds will grow 10 foot tall rather than 6 foot tall and fall over, and I won't have a crop. So that's why I don't, one of the reasons I don't manure. But what I want to do is integrate that more with some animal production, which is why a friend Colin's coming, hopefully to do some chickens, maybe some sheep, because you can integrate that into the crop rotations very well, add a little bit more fertility. They can help eat weeds. All my waste tail grain from cleaning can go to chickens. You know, we might as well be looking at it as an integrated, sustainable whole. I think it is possible to grow cereals in a stockless system, as they say, without any animal input, but I'd much prefer to do it. So it's still a work in progress, this story.
It's I have to say I'm captivated. It's a really, really good story.
Stopped talking, I told you.
I listened. It's fantastic. I'm gonna pause this one now and we'll start the recording.
I wouldn't mind a copy of that to my mother.
Copy. Yeah, yeah, you can have
it. Actually first say like, so, that's what John's doing.
John, do you wanna say hi, Mum?
Hi, Mom.
He's stuffing his face with pizza now.
Hi, Mom. I wish you were here and I wish I was there and I wish you could see what I'm doing.
He's doing a good job here, definitely.